Hello and welcome to Kicking It Off, the podcast for those interested in sports, football, and the coaching of young children. Every week, Dad and I get to sit down with the people shaping the game, from grassroots coaches to international managers. Today's guest is Diogo Coutinho, a UEFA A-licensed coach and assistant professor at the University of Maia in Portugal. With a background in youth coaching and a deep focus on performance analysis, Diogo is best known for his work on small-sided games and how smart training design can unlock more adaptable and creative players. Blending academic insight with real-world coaching, Diogo's here to show us how science and football can come together on the pitch.
And if you allow me just to congratulate you both because of this project, I have been listening to some episodes and it's great.
Oh, thank you.
So congratulations.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's just been the nicest time that we just get to spend some time together. Being someone who's not, obviously, I've grown up with a dad who's very much involved in this kind of stuff and now getting my own interest in it. It's just been so nice to just have a bit of a project together. So that means a lot. Thank you so much.
It's perfect. So congratulations. It's a good way to spend time together.
Oh, thank you. Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And as always, one of the first things we like to know about people, is what has your journey been? And yours sounds like a really interesting one from the bits that Dad has told me, possibly more of an academic side that's then come into the actual practicality of things. So it'd be great to just hear from you how you've got into this world.
So I would say that at least football, it was in my life since the very beginning. And as soon as I realized that I would not be able to be a player, it turned out to be a coach. And I think that came quite soon, because by 19, I saw that I will not be able to play at professional level, of course. And so I joined university. And at that moment, it was to be a football coach. Luckily, when I finished my master, I had an opportunity to engage in a grant that I would say opened my doors to research. And during that time, I was balancing, because during the day I was working in a lab in which I supported research. And then by night I was coaching youth players. And then for me, it was great because it grew my passion by understanding more about research, but mainly to trying to understand what I was doing with the children. And so it was the perfect, I would say, equilibrium between the theory and the practice. Then I got also a grant for doing my PhD. And so I was basically trying to research what I was doing, how to improve their practices. And so it was one way to combine, I would say, both worlds. And basically this turns out my path and my course over the last years, which I am still doing, because now I am lecturer, I am also at the practice and trying to do some research.
So you're almost in a unique position where you're working across professional football and also having an academic and a research background. You can bring the two things absolutely together to benefit any players of any age in front of you. I think that's quite unique.
Yeah, I think that more than ever, people are more open to science. I think that we have been able to at least develop more applied research. So now we are looking for problems that are real on the practice. And by doing that, we are, I'm saying, creating a bridge between the two domains. And this is becoming helpful. And for me, it's great because I can give you an example. For example, as coach, often we try to add corridor and sectorial lines during our training sessions. And one of my studies in the PhD, it was trying to understand How does that affect the youth player's performance? Because often we add that type of configurations to improve their movement synchronization. But what we found, it was the opposite. Because when we add the lines, they focus on the space. So we are changing the information that they use to make decisions. And so it was quite the opposite of my expectations. And so this is how it has been helping me in terms of designing training sessions.
Are there any other examples? Because obviously we're here to pick your brains so that we get everything great that's going on in Portugal. And
we're just here to steal things, basically.
We're here under false pretenses. We really do want to know more about the kind of areas of research that you've looked into. And like the example you've just used, sometimes it's almost counterintuitive what the research actually tells us. Are there any other examples or another 10?
What I mean is that often what we want is trying to improve the player's decision-making. So this should be our aim while also amplifying their capabilities, namely at least in young level, both the physical and the technical ones. So what we have been trying to do over the last years is trying to understand that when we vary something in the task, something in the game, we are changing the information. And with that change, we try to understand how they adjust. For example, we know that players are used to reference lines, not in this case, the pitch and the corridor and sectorial lines, but for example, the external pitch boundaries. And when we draw a task with it, they have better performance because they can understand the space that they have. If we change, for example, imagine that during the practices, and I think that at a youth level, it happens quite often, the kids play the formal game in the longitudinal way. But often during the practice, we might have more children, and so we have to adjust the game configuration from the lateral side to the lateral side. We also saw that that kind of situation decreases their movement coordination, so players are less collective, because they are used to make decisions based on the usual references that they have. So this is the type of research that we have been trying to do. And with that, we can try to design training tasks in which first we try to understand how they guide their decision making and also how can we adjust what we want to give to them. So this can be another example of what we have been doing. And often, a good thing that we have been doing in our research center, the CIDEST, is that we try to combine the different domains. So the physical, the technical, and the tactical. And I will give you an example. Players will run more when they have less synchronization. So using my previous example, when we added the reference lines, inside ones, the sectorial and corridor lines, what we found is that the players play further from each other. And by playing further, they have less ability to stay synchronized. And with that, they increase the distance cover because they have less coordination, so they are less prepared, for example, for a moment where they lose the ball. In addition, we also saw that if the teams are more spread on the pitch, they use more often the pass. But if the teams are close to each other, they use more the dribble to try to create space. So we have been trying to change different configurations and combine these three domains to trying to have a more holistic view of their performance.
Because that's quite interesting. If we want to produce practices that are going to give the players more opportunities to dribble, then part of my thinking is if we give them more space, they're going to have more space to dribble into. But actually, it's the opposite. They're more likely to pass the ball if the distances are bigger.
Yeah, because we first need to think, I believe, that what I need to understand from the game. So if there is a higher distance between teammates and also the opponents, it is likely that I have more chances to perform a successful pass. So it is likely that the players will use the pass as a way to communicate and to progress on the pitch. However, if we narrow the pitch, it might happen as well that I have to use the dribble if I receive the ball and I have immediate pressure.
Yeah.
And in that case, if I do that conditions, it will mean that the players will be more compact. And so often they use the dribble to try to at least gain time to perceive the environment. And so this is something that tries to help them. And in fact, it's curious that you mentioned dribble, because I think that is a skill that we do not develop quite well, because we often see progressive possession, these type of game models, and we encourage that quite often, but we are limiting the player's ability to develop the dribbling, which is a crucial skill. Namely, I would say current days where we find teams that are more able to defend, where the strategical plan is quite clear. So dribbling is a critical skill at the youth level.
Yeah, I think if we lose that, then the teams that park the bus, one way we can gain an advantage is for one of my players to beat one of your players and then try to disrupt the organised defence in that way. So I think it's a critical skill for adult players, but also for the very young. I think it's a really good way to hook them into the game of football and the enjoyment that can come from it. And also, at the same time, you're developing some important skills.
I totally agree with you, because this is not just related with adults. It's also even with children, because I would say that at a very young age, what we like to see, as if we were children, is that we have the ability to overcome opponents. We have the ability to stay in possession. And there is a specific phase during their childhood in which we should encourage this ability to stay in possession. Despite we are playing a collective game, yeah, it's important that they have this trust, this confidence to stay on the possession, to try to dribble, because this will inspire their creativity and also will refine their technical skills. So we should provide space for these type of actions. And later, there is a higher sense of collective behavior. And at that moment, we can try to emphasize the pass, because the dribble can be quite unique and can help us at different situations.
And so, can I just ask, all of this research that you're doing, you're obviously finding lots of surprises along the way and things that you thought would be one thing but actually turn out to be the opposite. Is this something that you share with your players, or is it useful to reserve that information from them? Does it give you better scope to influence their development, or is it something that's useful to share?
Yeah, good question.
It's a great question. I would mean that we try to balance. So when we think about designing training tasks, probably we keep that to us. So we try to design the better configurations. But when we think about their decision-making, that I would say that we try to provide information. So we can try to see, for example, if we mention about scanning and when they should scan or which spaces they should look at, we can try to provide that type of information. And so when we change the configurations, we are changing the information. So we can help the players to be fine-tuned with the information that is critical for their decision-making. I would say that we can try to guide where they should look at, not immediately saying, but trying to provide them clues or using the questioning to try to ask them how can they improve their decision-making during the practice. So I would say that is this balance. Is information that they need to know, such as these examples of scanning, and there are other information that I think that is better for us as coaches to be able to create enriching learning environments.
Yeah, I think your point about the different returns from different training configurations or practice configurations, the players don't really need to know about that, but you'll have a better idea about what the returns will be by organising the practice in this way. You mentioned scanning, and it's a big topic in England, Diogo. And we go from lots and lots of information to the players. We go from coaches constantly shouting on, you know, check your shoulder, all of those things. Is there anything that you can tell us about, particularly the areas to scan, what you're looking for, how long you should look for, those kind of things, just so that any coaches listening to this, they're going to have a slightly better and deeper understanding of, you know, what we should be helping the players to get better at?
Yeah, sure, great. I will try to divide my answer into perspectives. The first one from the training session, what we can do. The second, trying to understand where they should look or when they should look. And here, I, of course, need to mention Guir Jordet, a teacher at a Norwegian university. He's great in this topic. But let's start by the training sessions. A thing that we also have been trying to research is that we often still rely on analytical drills to improve the player's performance. And I mean that is moving away from the needs for doing a scanning. Yeah. If I am just doing a passing pattern without opposition that is in a static environment, I do not need to perform such type of action. So I mean that we can try to develop the player behavior by understanding how can we change the boundary conditions on the task. And if we can emphasize cooperation and opposition, we can try to integrate that perspective on the task. Of course, that I can start by the scanning using more analytical drills in which a player receives the ball, and if the coach appears by the right or the left, he should, before receiving the pass, try to understand his positioning to guide the ball reception. And this can be a starter, but I think that is more important to create different type of games where they have to be exposed to different contexts of searching for information. Let's use, for example, a rondo. At 3 against 3, plus 3 support players and 1 floater that is inside of the pitch. We can ask this floater to play with mandatory 2 touches. This means that he will need to receive and pass to someone that is open. And by having to do these 2 touches, he will need to try to perceive where is coming the pressure.
Yeah.
And this is a small example. I can also emphasize games, again, in which we have, for example, imagine that there is a counterattack. So we can start by a team playing 3 against 2, like a wave. But as soon as the first touch is given, 2 or 3 defenders will come from the back because this is the game. So they know that they have to make fast decisions. They need to go forward to the goal. And we are focusing on the principles of play, but also communication, space exploration, and time, which is crucial. Yeah. And then, of course, we can design tasks where we can amplify the need to search for information. Also, we have also researched that, for example, we can have both teams using the same color vests or the same outfit. So while we might think that they are not able to play, they are. It will be for us as coaches more difficult to understand who belongs to each team than for them to play. Also, we can, for example, because we also tested it using an eye patch, and for example, can see the ones from the Pirates where they can use in one eye, and this will cover part of the information that they can perceive. So by using these, I would say, configurations, these conditions, we can try to amplify their ability to scan because this is critical. And so I think that if we expose them more often to game-based situations, we are encouraging the scanning behavior. And this will turn natural because they will feel comfortable in staying in possession, comfortable in dealing with pressure, comfortable in dealing with the situations. What we need to do is trying to adjust our game according to our players' capabilities.
Yeah.
Now moving on to the second part. I mean, what we know from the research from Geert is that we should try to scan when a player is in possession. So when we think about scanning, it means that I do not have the ball and I need to look for information. So if my teammate has the ball perfectly controlled in his foot, it's not a proper time. And the reason is simple. If he decides to pass the ball in that moment and I'm looking away, when I am turning to see the ball is already in its path. And I do not have enough time to process the speed and the distance to perform a proper recovery. So often what we say is that we should scan when my player touched the ball, not to pass, for example, to carry it or to dribble. Because it's the moment in which the ball is further from the foot and will not change the direction.
Yeah.
So this will give me time to perceive the environment and return to the ball. Because it's critical to see, and this is clear for any team sport, there are sports in which the interception is critical. And for me to perceive the object moving, I need to perceive when it's released. So this is the moment in which I should try to scan in every single moment. The same when I am defending. I need to pay attention to the ball when the offensive player is with the ball. Because if I'm just seeing the attacker movement, I might lose where the ball goes. And then I have to look to the ball and then I lose the attacker. So often is related with this, the moment in which the ball is further away from the foot of the player that has the ball in possession.
Hi coaches, just a quick break to remind you about our 10-week coaching plan that's available now. It's the perfect support for the start of the new season, helping you structure your sessions with expert guidance and keep your players developing whilst having fun. For more information and to start using the plan today, head to thesessioncollective.co.uk. And so the first bit is about, in your practices, we really have to give the players a reason for scanning. So in your counter-attack example, having recovering defenders ensures that there is danger coming from all angles. And so the players have a reason to scan. And I think that's a really nice one to introduce the idea to coaches so that when they're planning their sessions, can they give the players a reason to scan? On your second one, knowing that if I'm traveling along the wing with the ball, when I push the ball out of my feet, my teammates, that's when they should be scanning because I'm not going to complete my next action. So that's when I'm really assessing and searching for information so that that's when the critical scanning and observation is actually done. When my teammate is ready to perform their next action, I should already be in a better position and know what the surrounding environment is. So that I think that for coaches, that's really clear.
And I feel like that linked in with the point that you made earlier of that it's community wasn't the word that you used, but that connection and actually knowing it's not just yourself that you need to be aware of. And yes, you obviously as a player need to have your own self-awareness of what is my next move, who is around me, but it's also having that awareness of who is around my team, because it's almost like, I don't know why I want to say spidey senses like Spider-Man. And actually with the eye patch on, removing part of one sense to then develop others, because it's about everything. It's about, can I feel if there are bodies coming towards me? Can I see in terms of the distance? Can I hear where either has a ball just been kicked or can I hear a shout saying this is the next move? Of fine tuning your senses as an individual player, but then as a team, because actually if we're getting to a point where we've got a really conducive, or we're really cooking with something that's got a lot of flavor. I'm not quite sure what I'm saying here. I feel like my brain has stopped working mid thought. But actually, if everybody's got that connection, then ultimately that's going to create a team that is individually very strong, and as a collective very strong.
They're in tune with each other, aren't they?
Yeah, I totally agree on that. And I mean, for me, it's all about decision making. So what we want is to have more space and time. And for that, we should be aware of our environment. Even for dribbling, and I just do not want to be or to not be right, because I still believe that analytical drill, it's important, namely when they are young. But I mean, we can try to use our training practice to develop their decision-making coupled with the technical actions. For example, for dribbling, I know that I need to look to the opponent, namely the foot, the hips, to try to understand his body orientation, the space and the ball. So if I'm just doing that to a marker, I'm not training the dribble, just the technical part. But we can try to encourage the children, the kids, to go home and bring a new dribble the next week. So that perspective of individual training, analytical one, can be done at home while we are trying to improve the time that they spend with us to improve their decision making. And if we combine, I mean, opposition and cooperation, they will be developing this decision-making. What we really need to know is what happens when we adjust the different, I mean, rules, the boundary conditions of the task, because this will emphasize what we want. So if we want to emphasize the space, I can use, for example, floaters, because there are always free players. If I want to explore more the dribble, probably smaller formats would be good, and without floaters to encourage the dribbling. So I just need to design the game for what I want, but guarantee that they will have the opportunity to improve their decision-making.
Yeah. Diogo, you mentioned earlier about combining the physical, technical and tactical together. I know you've done some work with Mr. Schulhorn around differential learning. Is that trying to combine all those things together, or is it more about movement variability?
Well, I think that we can combine both. So moving to variability, the theory from Wolfgang Schulhorn, I mean differential learning, what we are trying to do is to, because, for example, if we look to the present, what we see is perfect conditions for practice. Our pitches are perfect. The balls are perfect. And in the past, we spent time playing at the street. We use the trees. So we have more variability. What we try now to do is try to increase fluctuations. And by fluctuations, I mean changing a lot the practices that they are doing. Here, what I would like to state is that often when coaches are seeing a practice with differential learning, they will feel that the players are failing, are not be successful, because the variability is about them exploring their actions, their body, and the space. So by trying to give an example, because it might be easier, we can imagine a 5-against-5 small-sided game. I can start in the first minute with the football ball. In the second minute, or when there is a goal, or the ball leaves the pitch, I can introduce a new type of ball, for example, a handball ball. And we found that when they play with a handball ball, because it's smaller, it will increase the speed. So players are more able to perform successful passes, even because it's harder for the defenders to steal it. Then at the third minute, we can introduce a rugby ball. And I think that the fun perspective here is that although in our eyes, what is happening is that the players will fail the pass because the ball trajectory is unpredictable, we can see from the positioning, that is what we do in research, that they play more compact. So they decrease the distance between them to guarantee that the ball has a lower trajectory to move. So right. They are basically looking for solutions.
Yeah.
And I think this is the way how we can improve their capabilities, because I will assume that during the match, I might not be able to do an action if I haven't tested or experienced it. So by using variability, they will have, I would say, a very large repertoire of experiences. And with that, we can improve their behavior. Also, two more points. In this case of the rugby ball, for example, it happened to me as coach. One of my players saw that by the ground, it would not be good to pass the ball, because it's quite unpredictable. So that player found that he could raise the ball and pass by the air and increase the assertiveness of his action.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not about being successful or not in that task. It's about making them thinking and looking for solutions. And this is what we want for a player. So this is a clear example. But of course, while they are playing with rugby ball, the performance are poor. But we need to encourage them to test it, to explore it. Because when we remove that and we add the football ball, it's like they feel freedom. So this is the way. I think that sometimes we can go beyond the game, be less representative. And this will amplify the players' opportunities for action. Often we can rely, if we look, for example, to stars, we can see Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He was quite good in the way how he scored goals, because when he was young, he performed martial arts. So the flexibility that he had from that sport helped him to scoring from amazing situations. And I think that the variability will give this to us. In addition, if I use a 5-against-5, three bouts in the same way, that task might just be providing the opportunity to two or three players to improve because are in accordance with their level. But if we use variability, which means that between bouts or between minutes, we change the conditions, we have at least the opportunity that one bout can benefit each player because there are different situations. So we are giving solutions to all of them to explore. And I think that this is important because they learn by their mistakes. And I think that is one of the best ways to learn.
Yeah, this is something we've touched on before, how important it can be for the learner to experience getting it wrong, ideally in an environment that accepts and encourages this part of learning, and for them to start learning how to deal with that and get more comfortable with it, and I suppose start to see how it can advance progress rather than stunt it. And it seems obvious that giving players the opportunity to solve a problem is key. And so I want to bring a sport into the conversation that I know both of you have a strong connection to, which is futsal. And futsal, to me, feels like a sport that, because everything is happening so quick and because there's just... It's closer. Your proximity to other people on that pitch is, you are physically closer. That, do you use futsal in your training sessions to offer your players an opportunity to develop their problem solving skills or their ability to assess what's going on? Because that feels like, to me, that would be a perfect sport to start to bring in.
I totally agree. In fact, futsal, it's a great sport. And returning to children, for example, I think that gave them the perfect conditions for development. First, I think that is easy to control the ball with the type of footwear that they use in that sport. And there are a lower number of players, so they can stay more time on the ball. And also the problems are different, as you said. So there is higher proximity with the defenders, higher proximity with the teammates. So they are encouraged to stay on possession more time. And with that, they will have to make decisions more frequently. Also, if the ball is changing quite often, they also will need to scan and so look for the information.
Yeah.
And so we are combining movement, which need to be fast, decision-making, and technical actions. So it's the perfect sport for it because they experience a lot, the passing, the dribbling, the shooting, which are core skills that they love in the game. So altogether, I think that is quite important for their development. And if we saw in the past also some players, we can see that Xavi, Iniesta, they started and played futsal. And that contributed for a greater technical development, which is crucial nowadays.
Yeah, because I know Portugal, their national futsal team, has obviously been really successful in Europe and in the FIFA World Cup tournaments. So would most Portuguese children at school be able to play futsal?
I would say that now more than ever. So I think that it's also related with the success of our sport. And in this case, we have been successful during the last year. So it has increased their interest from futsal. But I would say that it's easier for them to play that sport because at least here we have, I would say, pitches everywhere, outside in every space. Of course, that it's not with the same surface, but it's a 5-on-5.
Yeah.
And so they love to play because the ball spend more time in play. As it is shorter, they can participate. And this is what we need to think. For example, if we go to an under 8 in football, imagine a 7-on-7 in the pitch that often might have 60 per 40 meters, something like that, I might touch the ball at every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And that is impossible. They have to touch frequently. And so it's also the feelings that we are working with the children because he is involved with the game.
Yeah.
So for me, it's crucial. And yes, with these last success that we have had, they have spent more time practicing. Also, I must assume that even with the weather conditions, sometimes it's great for the parents because they are at least starting in a good environment for them to start developing their skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And often, at least here, what we do is trying to balance. If an under 6, under 7, under 8 has 2 sessions, one can be indoor and the other outdoor. So football and or soccer and futsal.
Yeah.
And then they are varying these. They have competition on both. And I think that this is enriching their experiences.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about adaptability and flexible decision-making and technical actions. I know some of your research was linked with creativity. This is something that we're obviously going after big style in this country. Is there anything from that area of research about how do you deal with or develop or work with players who you think have got that potential to be creative? What kind of, you know, things could coaches think about if they've got those kind of players within their teams or in their squads?
Well, this is also a great question. So I think that to start, it's about how we design the session. And if we return to the previous questions, we can see that if we are able to create challenging environments, which means challenging tasks, and I mean by challenging, often we need to feel what the game gives to us. So opposition, cooperation, trying to score goals, defend, protect. So this is the first situation. Then if I add variability, I will amplify the possibilities that a talented player or a creative one would be challenged. And of course, these type of players like challenges. They like to try to see if they can solve them or not. So if we use variability, we basically every day are exposing them to a new problem.
Yeah.
And so they are challenged to do something new. Also, I think that often we believe that it's just by the way how we design the tasks. I think that we also should be open to co-adapt the task with the players. So sometimes we can give freedom to the players to create their own game. This can be done at arrival activities or even during the practice. And I mean, when designing, while we are in a team sport, I think that is important that we can have, for example, returning to the previous example of 3-2 and then coming out 3 more defenders, we can have our main objective being, for example, decision-making linked with the penetration principle of play, but then combining with individualities of the players. So I know that a player might feel more difficulties in dealing, for example, with scanning. So I can start the game at the left side so he is without the possession and have more time to think about it. Also, yeah. I can try to vary the number of defenders that we will face according to the player's level. So we can try to include individual learning objectives for each player within the task. While we draw it for the team, for the collective, it is possible to still introduce individual goals. And with that, I think that we can improve the players.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. Final one then, Diogo, while we've got you here. How can we help our coaches produce the next Ronaldo for England?
Now, that is a great question. And of course, Ronaldo, it's a great player. But I think, honestly, at least first he gave us the best answer. It's about work, hard work. I think that what we should try to do is be the best version of ourselves. So if we try to improve every single day, and if our coaches help us with defining these goals for us at every single session, I think that every player will have the opportunity to be the best version of himself. So I would say that that should be the goal. And honestly, if you allow me, since we are almost to conclude, to say that it's a pleasure to be here with you, both of you. And I would like to mention Pete because you are doing a great job in England. And I had the opportunity to see that over the last years. And I think that England is working well and that can be visible for the performance of the youth teams. It's important to be aware that this is a process that will take time. But honestly, I think that you are on the right direction. And so also would like to say this to you because you have been doing such a great job in improving the lifestyle, the quality of the game in youth football in England.
Thank you, Diogo. And it's not without your influence, because we've known each other for a number of years now, and I was desperate to involve you in our Advanced Youth Award, and you were really kind enough to come over and help us and present around your research, present around your practical application of this. And I think I was open to all of the things that were important to you. So I think it's been a really great relationship that we've both hopefully both benefited from. And hopefully over the next few years, our youngest players will continue to benefit from that. So, you know, equally, I've got to thank you for your expertise and for obviously joining us today.
I am the one that appreciates. And if the coaches act like you, because you gave opportunity to others. So you just provide trust and confidence, in this case, to researchers, to people. So if us as coaches give that opportunity for the players to express themselves, to test it, to explore environments, I think that is the way. So they have a great example at home.
Thank you, Diogo.